It's a Klingon podcast. You got to threaten them somehow.
Yes. Listen or else. Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Sutai Vampir and Jajim Vestai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am your host, Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today, we are going to talk about another Keith R.A. DeCandido book, The Brave and the Bold, Book 2, Part 4, entitled The Final Artifact.
Now, should mention that Book 1 was Parts 1 and 2. Book 2 is Parts 3 and 4. So, basically, we're looking at half of the book here when we're looking at the final artifact portion of it.
And only 25% of the whole story. Published in December of 2002. There it is. That's what we got. And John, why don't you give us a brief summary of the plot?
Okay, before going into what's on the back of the book, let me point out that parts 1, 2, 3, and 4 are divided up in such a way that there are four artifacts that they're looking for. Each part is a different artifact. So each part deals with some AE that does something for the entire whole. That's going to have a big thing for the final artifact. When the final artifact is unearthed on Narinda 3, it leads to several mysterious disappearances throughout Federation and Klingon space, including Federation ambassadors Spock and Worf. Okay, first of all, right off the bat, that tells us that this story is set after DS9 concludes and Worf has been made an ambassador. Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the Starship Enterprise joins forces with Captain Clagg. And because we have Captain Clagg, that puts it after the Dominion War, which kind of confirms the after DS9 thought. Of the IKS Gorkon, but even the greatest vessels of two nations may not be enough when the deadly secret of the final artifact is revealed.
Yes, it's kind of an interesting story that we got going on here. And, you know, we are only looking at part of this right now. Let's go ahead and have your overall impressions.
Okay. What I've got written here is that Keith took the idea of writing a Star Trek saga. I'm getting these thoughts from the afterword at the back of the book. A Star Trek saga of several other ships in the Star Trek universe. Not the Enterprise, not Voyager, not DS9, you know, but ships that are referred to, but ones that we don't see on a regular basis. We've got the USS Hood, captained by DeSota. We've got the IKS Gorkon, captained by Clagg. They bring Commodore Decker and the Marquis in. They bring Cal Hudson back, you know. He just wanted to bring all the characters that have been referred to and give them another shot at happening. We saw the same thing happen back when we did Forged by Fire, and it gave Sulu another story, and it gave us a chance to see Curzon Dax in action. Keith wanted to introduce Tuvok to the Marquis. I mean, the beginning of Voyager, he's a Federation agent. Embedded in the Maquis, spying for the Federation. Well, How did he get there? One of the questions that Keith answers. Another thing is, Clagg and Riker have a relationship. He gives us a reunion with Clagg and Riker. We've seen two major Federation ambassadors, Spock and Worf. Well, he kind of throws them together. And it becomes a really interesting plot line. We're going to talk about it after a bit as to what happens with those two. He pitched it to the editors of Pocketbook, came up with four parts of the story. But this is the only one, the final artifact is the only one that has a Klingon-centric theme. And since this is a Klingon-centric book discussion, that's why we're only discussing the final part.
So you have read the other three parts then?
I've read the third and fourth part, but I haven't read the first two.
Oh, okay. So you have a little bit of a handle on what's going on here. You know, this is, you know, as we said, this is the last segment of a much larger work that was in two volumes. The story was not standalone for the most part. Kind of in retrospect, I wish we had read the entire work. You suggested we might do that, but I didn't think we really needed to, and I'm having regrets over that.
It would have been nice to see how the original Enterprise dealt with the artifact they found.
Yeah.
And I forget who is the team that was in book two or in part two. I can't remember.
I don't either. But you know, at the same time, it was still a satisfying story, and the characters in this story were just absolutely spot on. And I enjoyed the interactions between them, between characters we had never seen together before. So it was a lot of fun to read that. I do intend to read the whole thing, though, in the very near future.
That's one thing that books can do. The television series can't. You have to pay a lot of money to get the actors to reprise their role in a television play, in a movie, in whatever production you're doing. But you can bring the characters back with a good writer that understands the characters and get into their heads in the written word, in a novel, in a story of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Keith is good at this.
He knows this series so well that, yeah, he knows everybody that's in there, and he even adds more to it. You know, we've talked about his genius before, and it is, again, it shows up here.
Very much so. You say Keith knows the series. Keith knows the characters, and that's a deeper understanding of the series than just what happened.
And speaking of characters, we have just an entire, in this particular volume, we have a huge group of very diverse.
Let's bring everybody back!
Yeah, a diverse cast for this book. We have Picard, Riker, we have Clagg, Dr. Borak, Rodek, Tarith, Jelang, Tok. We have Ambassador Spock and Worf and Admiral McCoy, and McCoy is about 149 years old in this. We have Kira Nerys, and then we have our villains, I guess, Malkus and Ajulak.
I'm not so sure Ajulak should be considered a villain in that she's trying to undo the damage that she did to give Malkus the devices that he's used to try and control people.
Mm-hmm. So let me give you just a brief summary, very brief summary of what takes place in this book. We have a character named Jelang, who is a Klingon sculptor who has been commissioned to create a sculpture on Narendra 3 depicting the alliance between the Federation, the Klingon Empire, and the Romulan Empire. And he is hoping that if he does very well at creating this, that he will be further commissioned to do statues for the Hall of Heroes on Kronos. And so he is trying to secure the materials to do this statue with and also prepare the site. And when they blow up a hill where the sculpture is to be placed, they find an artifact. And this artifact is containing our villain called Malchus, who is using mind control techniques to control numbers of people. Now, there are three other pieces to this artifact. And if all four of them come together, nothing will stop him from being able to control the entire known universe, and which would effectively make him the ruler of the universe.
Another caveat to that, too, is I don't think Malchus was actually incorporated in the final artifact. The way I looked at it was, it was an AI that took on his personality. So it would have been, an AI that was going to be controlling the universe.
Okay. So at any rate, he does have control over Spock, Worf, McCoy, and Kira. Spock, McCoy, Kira, and DeSoto. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and they also have other parts of the artifact. And he does get all four parts and puts them together. However, he is prevented from his final...
It don't work.
It doesn't work because there is a small piece missing. So he sends everybody out, all the people that he controls, to find this part and bring it back and make it whole. And that never happens.
Well, they find the part. They just don't get it to the... the proper device to get the device fixed.
And Ajulak comes along and she makes sure that she gets her, she defeats Malchus. Everybody gets together on Narendra 3. Malchus is defeated and the universe is saved from being controlled. And Malchus just kind of fades into oblivion, probably never to be heard from again.
Actually, one of the interesting things is Ajulak kind of defeats Malchus, and then something happens and her attempt dies away, so it ends up being Clagg and the Enterprise that comes in and does their thing and puts Malchus down.
Yeah, they come up with an idea that if they use the Enterprise's deflector dish to put out a pulse that they can stop Malchus from using his mind control to get his minions to do things. The funny thing of it is in this story, is talk of the Gorkon and Data of the Enterprise are the two that are competing to find this solution first. And what's really cool is talk comes up with the idea of what to do, and Data comes up with the idea of how to do it.
Data and Geordi, yeah. Well, let's just face it. Talk comes up with the science. Geordi and Data come up with the engineering. That's what it kind of breaks down to. And Clagg is insufferably pleased that his guy did it.
Yes. And so was I, to be honest. Now, we have... some of these characters we should probably discuss a little bit. We have Spock and Worf together as ambassadors. And we have Admiral McCoy and Borak. Now, Borak is the Gorkon's doctor. She is taking him to a conference. She is taking McCoy to a conference to talk about medicine, which comes from the last book we read, where Martok has commissioned a new medical organization.
Which is really interesting because this particular book is set between Diplomatic Implausibility, another Gorkon book, and A Good Day to Die, which is the first book in the Gorkon series.
Mm-hmm. And then we have...
and long before A Burning House.
Yeah. We have Colonel Kira... she's a colonel, so we know that this is later after Deep Space Nine, as you mentioned, and idea she winds up as a gunner on the Gorkon.
A successful gunner.
Yeah.
She hits things.
So what this book, the strength of this book, without knowing the entire story, the strength of this book is putting characters together.
And having them work together.
And characters you hardly ever, you never see together before. DeSoto is kind of, he's kind of out there by himself a little bit.
Well, he's the one that has to go and get the artifacts that are stored on Earth so they can't be used.
Now, DeSoto, he is, if I'm not mistaken, he is the captain that got in trouble at some point.
He's the commander of the Hood, and I can't remember if he was Riker's captain or Tuvok's captain at one point.
Well, he was Riker's captain. I know that, so I might be thinking of someone else. So, you know, there's kind of in a nutshell what this particular story is about, at least from what I know of it.
It's basically bringing all these guys together, getting all these guys to work together, getting these two empires to work together to defeat a galactic threat. And it works!
Yeah. And, you know, let's look at some of the things that we found in this story that were interesting. A living consciousness stored in a machine that has been split up and buried for thousands of years. 90,000 years, to be precise, is what I think it said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's face it. There are what? There's been what? Two or three other old races in the Star Trek universe that have kind of died out, gone away, but their artifacts keep popping up.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the Sentry from Next Generation.
Yeah, Portal.
You've got the artifacts that show how all the humanoid races of Star Trek are interconnected by another race. You know, the Slavers from Star Trek, the animated series, who were a race long time ago. So,
well, in the psionic device that Picard defeated, we have not only that, but we have the orbs, for crying out loud, on Bajor. So, yeah, we have a lot of artifacts in Star Trek that cause problems or offer solutions.
Solve problems, or yeah. But so yeah, it's not new to have old races popping up, but it does make for a good plot if you do it right.
Yeah. We have Clagg, who is happy to be working with the Enterprise again. You know, we know that Clagg really does like Riker. They're friends from their time on the Pock together. You know, it's really refreshing to see that this alliance between the Klingons and the Federation is still intact and working well for the most part.
And we're going to see, well, we've already talked about it, but in the next four books of the Gorkon series, we're going to see that the people of the Klingon Empire, the heads of the Defense Force members of the Klingon Empire, aren't all in lockstep with working with the Federation.
No.
And we're going to see why, you know, each side thinks the way it does.
And as you mentioned before, these events are set between diplomatic implausibility and a good day to die.
It also explains the reference that Clagg was making to his first officer who had died in the line of duty that we didn't see in either diplomatic implausibility or a good day to die.
Yeah, Tareth.
Tareth was not, we didn't know what happened with her, you know. This deals with that.
Yes. A disloyal gunner caused Tareth's death. And, yeah, we don't even find out what happens to that gunner, but we're pretty sure he's not going to live long because at the end of the book, Clagg looks at him and says, "I will kill you later." which I thought was a funny little line that came from somewhere else.
You mean like Star Trek 3?
Something like that, yeah.
You promised to kill me! I lied.
Yeah. One of the things that I really enjoyed reading about in here was Spock reinforcing his own ego, id, or whatever it would be, reinforcing himself against Malchus by mind-melding with Worf.
Yeah, the whole mind-meld thing. The switching of the personalities of the two of them was an amazing read. Worf, stoic warrior who just wipes everybody out, you know, with rage and everything, becoming the logical person who would only defeat somebody with a nerve pinch. And Spock becoming a all-compassing attack demon,
mm-hmm.
like a Klingon.
Well, in that chapter where that takes place, Worf is reliving things that Spock did, and there's warrior tendencies in there, and then Spock is reliving things that Worf did, and they're sharing these memories and kind of mixing up with each other.
One of the problems with mind melds and how they've been depicted in either TV movies or in a lot of books is they're really just superficial. Oh, I'm putting my hands on your head and now we're communicating. Keith took it a lot deeper. Keith added a lot more dimension to what was going on in the Spock-Worf connection.
Yeah, we got to see a real interaction between the two characters.
Between the brains.
Yeah, that was really neat. And the effects of this carried over and continued on for quite some time, but I guess they do fade after a while.
They just haven't got to the point in this story anyway where they faded away, but we know in later works by Keith, because Worf is in a burning house and is not feeling any of the effects of this mind meld. So yeah, they're going to go away, even if the same author is writing about them.
So why don't we move on to the adventures that they had here? Why don't you go ahead and take over?
Well, this story brings all the pieces that Keith has built in the past together for the finale, particularly the four different artifacts coming together. We've talked about this already, that he's bringing all these characters together and how they're going to interact. Characters that normally don't interact with each other. We've talked about Spock and Worf, but you've also got McCoy and Boorka. Yeah, Boorka, who Boorka has looked on McCoy as an inspiration in her attempts to revolutionize Klingon medicine, so to speak, bring it into a era where she can actually heal warriors that have been wounded so that they can go back into battle.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, you know, like I said, all the artifact pieces coming together, a piece missing that causes massive pain in Malchus and doesn't allow him to mind control the universe like he wants. He gets lots of people under his thrall, but it's just not what he's looking for.
Yeah, there were several ships that were in orbit around Narendra 3 ready to stop Enterprise and Gorkon from doing what they intended to do, but thanks to Talk and Data, that didn't happen. They were able to stop that, and it was kind of funny how everybody just kind of woke up and said, oh, what are we doing? Where are we? What's going on? So Malchus had good control over them. If he had been able to do what he intended to do, it would have been the end of civilization, period.
Well, there's two ways you can look at mind control. You can go in and you can take over somebody's mind to the point that they're just lost. They don't know what the heck they're doing. It's it's not them anymore. Or you can do mind control where the person you're controlling knows everything that they're doing, but they can't do anything about it. Kind of the problem here, especially when you talk about how when they wake up, what happened? What's going on? We kind of get the feeling in this story that you've got both types going on.
Yes.
Because if you've totally buried your captive's personality, well, they can't resist you. They don't know to resist you. They're just, their bodies are just doing what you tell them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we've got Spock and Kira and a few others resisting Malekith's control, which gives you the impression that they can sense what's going on, at least if not see outside their body as to what they're doing, at least see that something is making them do something they don't want to do, enough that they're going to stop whatever is happening to whatever's controlling it, so they can get back control and see what the hell they're doing.
Yeah. Well, Malekith's control was limited because he didn't have all four of the artifacts together.
But the limit on Malekith's control was the number of people he could control. We don't know how deep that control went on each individual that he was able to control.
Yeah, he was getting spread a little too thin, and the problem was he was missing a piece of one of the artifacts.
Enough so that the artifacts couldn't be assembled in the rectangle that made the artifact whole and do its full job that it was supposed to do.
So you have under concepts here, how far would you go to correct a mistake, and how long would you wait to correct it?
Idyllic waited 90 some thousand years to fix things instead of going, oh, it's been 1,000 years. Nothing's happening. Well, maybe they got destroyed somehow. She just kept after it. She just kept going.
But she had some problems with this, apparently, probably in the earlier installments for this story. She had done some things that caused her to be in trouble with at least the Federation, and she winds up in a brig.
But Jim, that's gonna be 89,900 or 800 years after she started waiting.
Ah.
She's waiting a long, long time, then she gets into trouble. At what point is she gonna quit if it never manifested itself?
So, a favorite point of plot, at least for me, I thought the entire story was good, but I especially enjoyed the ending wrap-up when McCoy and Spock got together in 10 Forward on the Enterprise and had a session of their usual back-and-forth banter.
Now, was that because Keith knew that if he didn't provide that type of scenario, the reader was going to go, oh, come on, they're going to argue with each other?
No. I don't think so. I think that was something Keith's sense of humor would not allow him to ignore, putting those two together one more time.
And you really got to wonder how many more times that was going to be available. How much longer can McCoy keep doing space travel? When does his body going to say enough is enough, and I got to sit down on my front porch with my mint julep and rest?
Well, he couldn't even have a real mint julep anymore.
Oh yeah, that's right. Medically, he couldn't do it. But
it mentioned in the story that he couldn't handle alcohol anymore, so it had to be a synthahol mint julep.
Which is interesting, because I still would like to know what synthahol is and how it does things. Because the thing with alcohol is, alcohol keeps changing its molecular formula from the moment you ingest it and it hits your stomach to the moment it turns into the molecule that affects your brain. And it does that because It has to get through the membranes of the body, but it can't get through the membranes unless it's converted itself into something that can go through the membranes.
That sounds like a very complex process.
Yeah. A lot of people that can't drink alcohol today get caught when the molecule alcohol turns into an aldehyde and doesn't pass through the system. And they're stuck with the aldehyde that's not really good for their stomach and become sick.
Oh, okay.
So what is synthahol? How does it get, what is it, why does it do things differently? And I don't know why they even came up with it. I think originally synthahol was devised as a taste thing. It tastes like alcohol, but doesn't affect the body like alcohol.
Yeah.
In other words, I thought early on, you can't get drunk from synthahol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no point in it.
No, it's just, it's a social thing.
Yeah.
Without the deleterious effects intact, as they would probably have put it.
But didn't I remember somewhere in Trek, somehow, there were people with hangovers from synthahol?
I don't recall ever a time with that.
Like I say, they didn't go deep enough into what this stuff was.
No. Well, you know, and I don't, they probably really didn't feel like they needed to when they wrote the stories, because it was just an excuse for a social gathering. I mean, let's face it, what would 10 Forward be on board a ship where everybody is supposed to be alert and ready to do things if everybody was schnockered?
Yeah. And it's like, well, you know why Isaac Asimov had his robots using a positronic brain?
Why?
Positron was a brand new concept when he was starting to write the stories, and it sounded like an interesting word. So that's kind of why he used it, and never went into why the brain had to be a positronic matrix to be able to do AI.
Oh, huh. So let's move along to themes. We have a couple of themes here. Galactic domination.
Yeah. What are you doing tonight?
Well, we're going to try to take over the galaxy like we always do.
It's supposed to be same thing as we do every night. Try to take over the galaxy.
Or the, in this case, the universe, the known universe. So, yeah.
Now, that's an interesting concept. The universe is expanding. How do you know when you've conquered the entire universe?
Well, and that's a really good question. You know, here we stand on the Earth, and we look up at the night sky, and we see
light pollution.
Well, beyond that, up here in Nebraska, we actually get to see stars. But you see a lot of stars, but you don't see even a tiny portion of the stars that exist. So how would you define a universe?
You mean define?
Yes.
Because what you said was, I was thinking you had a stick in your hand that is shaped like a Y, and you're out there trying to divine the universe.
No. How would you define the universe? At what scale? Now, we have amazing telescopes. We have electronic devices that can look far, far at other galaxies. And we know that the universe is very, very large.
There's another problem, Jim. If you're looking to see the edge of the universe, you're looking like 14 billion years in the past. Not what it is today. Not where it's at today, but in the past.
Which is one of the reasons, I think, that makes it very difficult for a person to wrap their minds around. And then working together to save the universe. This was brilliant. This was an absolute brilliant story showing people, diverse peoples from all over the place, coming together to work on a problem.
Yeah. Diverse is the key, I mean, here. you weren't in lockstep the way it usually is in Star Trek. Roddenberry's rule, there can be no conflict on the ship. So that ain't the case here, because everybody's different. Everybody's got their own way of doing things. But because you've got a common enemy, you come together and use your strengths and your weaknesses to defeat that enemy, basically overcoming whatever needs to be overcome with the way you can do it.
And I think that concept that Roddenberry had, that you do not have conflicts on a ship, would only apply to the Federation, because as we know, the Gorkon has had no shortage of onboard problems with people who disagree with other people.
Jim, the Gorkon series was written after Roddenberry died.
Well, I'm aware of that, for crying out loud.
And after they launched the series Voyager, which had conflicts within the crew itself. It's the reason you have DS9 and its corollary Babylon 5 being space stations, so that people can disagree and people can have conflicts and Roddenberry will keep quiet.
How about closing thoughts?
Oh, man. We have looked at a lot of Keith's books in these last few months, haven't we?
Oh, yes.
But has it been a problem?
I mean, not for me.
Keith's really good. I don't think there's any bad book in this bunch. Any book that you would not tack a 5-star on. Any book that's weak. They're all superb.
Completely agree. I'll tell you what, I have never, ever been disappointed with anything I have read coming from Keith. His knowledge, his subject knowledge, his research and everything just seems to be so good. And he has resources. He'll consult other authors and other sources to bring together and make something that is actually feels like Star Trek. And things I would love to see some of these books that we have read made into films.
Well, keep in mind that if you make them into films, you're going to lose a lot. I think a lot of the subtlety that Keith brings into these books can only be brought in via the written form, via our ability to get into the mind of the person, of the character that we're reading about.
Yeah.
As far as Keith's knowledge of the genre is concerned, years ago, I was on a panel with Keith on Klingon culture.
Mm-hmm.
As the moderator of the panel, I really just wanted to keep pointing things at Keith. It's tough because as a moderator, I'm supposed to get everybody in. But Keith was so good at talking about this stuff that I just wanted to keep. No. Sharon, sit down. Let's Keith talk.
Yeah.
You know, it's just.
I was
he's
there.
He's amazing.
I was there for that panel. And
okay, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, and several others. And 50 minutes was not enough.
No.
I could have.
Keith knows too much.
I could have listened to this guy for 6 hours.
That's despite the fact, I didn't know it at the time. That's despite the fact that the other guy on the panel was the founder of the Klingon Assault Group, John Haverson.
Mm-hmm.
But Keith was just so good.
Yeah, he's a great guest. I'll tell you what, we've talked to him, you and I. We have talked to him on this show. You ask him a question, you get a $10 answer every time.
And he's not making it up on the spur of the moment. He's thought about this stuff.
Well, yeah. And you know what? His excitement about the subject is contagious.
And if you ask the question, why make up a Klingon language? Why research Klingon culture? Neither one exist. Neither one are real. They're imaginary. They're made up. But by looking at the process of making them up, making up the language, making up the culture, making up the traditions, it gives you a window on how your traditions, your culture, and your language is made up. It gives you insights into yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So for next month,
One more thing.
Okay, go.
Get out there and read the books, guys. We mean it. If you haven't already, go pick them up and read these things. They're great.
Yeah. So, all right.
For next month.
Yes, for next month, we will be looking at The Left Hand of Destiny, Book 1, by J.G. Hertzler and Jeffrey Lang, which is kind of an interesting thing because you remember the name of the sculptor I mentioned way back at the beginning of the show?
You said it was Jewel Lang or something like that?
Jelang, yes. I have a sneaking suspicion that Jelang was a reference to author Jeffrey Lang, who is also a very accomplished Trek author in his own right.
Or Keith was just thinking about dessert. He was going to have Jell-O.
And I seriously doubt that. But this is going to be interesting because I don't think we have read a book by one of the actors yet, have we?
No, there aren't a lot of those. And again, being one of the actors, I wonder how much of the story is from JG, because there are several actors who will hear my fingers are up in the air doing quotation marks, write a book, and they've really given no input into it. I doubt that's the case with JG. He's just doesn't seem to me to be that kind of a person. He's got to have some input into it.
Yeah, I would think. Maybe we can ask him and find out.
Sometime. JG's always around. If you haven't been to a convention with JG yet, or even Robert O'Reilly, you need to get there. And if they're both there, you're in for an experience.
Oh, my gosh. Of course, with these virtual things that we're having to do lately, a group called GalaxyCon did have a panel with both JG and Robert on, and it was absolutely hilarious all the way through. These two guys are the best of friends, but they are absolutely brutal when they talk to each other.
And if you can see them in person, they do a lot of physical comedy on stage in addition to their verbal comedy. So there's another dimension than just the virtual stuff.
Oh, my gosh. Hopefully someday I get a chance to do that. So that's going to bring us to the end of this edition of Bound by Honor. Go out.
Did we say the name of the next book?
Yes, I think I did. Left Hand of Destiny, Book 1.
And then you can delete this whole thing if you've already done that.
Okay. So
I know we talked about the authors, and I didn't know if we'd mentioned the actual title.
Oh, yeah, we did. All right. So if you're looking to listen to us, of course, if you are listening to us now, you've obviously already found us. But hey, why don't you go and tell a friend? Or tell someone you're acquainted with, or even tell someone you don't like, how to find us on Apple Podcasts, how to find us at kag.org/podcast, and get in there and get us some listeners. And you know what? If we deserve it, a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts wouldn't hurt. It would sure get us up there on the list and more recognized. So with that, I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time on Bound by Honor.
Or else, kapwa.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon.
Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!